Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, if you're looking for guidance going into the new year, you may want to visit the unique historic town of Casadega.
We feel that we are here to have people explore what spirituality is for them. And we feel that there's a difference between religion and spirituality.
We'll discuss the legacy of Ponce de Leon.
If the inclusion or exclusion of Juan Ponce de Leon from college-level textbooks is any indication, he is generally allotted only a sentence or two, or ignored entirely.
And we'll visit the 1927 courthouse in Orlando, home of the Orange County Regional History Center. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Created in the late 19th century, the community of Casadega is located about 3/4 of a mile south of Lake Helen and 6 miles from DeLand. Casadega was originally intended to be the winter residence for spiritualists from Lilydale, New York. The spiritualists of Casadega were welcomed by residents of Volusia County who believed Casadegans would benefit the local economy. By the early 20th century, spiritualists were living in Casadega year-round. Spiritualists believe in an infinite intelligence, hands-on healing, and direct communication with the spirit world. In 1880, George P. Colby filed a homestead claim for nearly 75 acres of land in central Florida with the intention of creating a community for spiritualists. In 1894, he established Casadega. In January 1895, Colby gave a warranty deed of 35 acres to the Southern Casadega Spiritualist Camp Meeting Association, the organization that still governs life in Casadega. Jody Martinez is a certified medium, healer, and teacher in Casadega.
George Colby, originally he was born in upstate New York, and then his family moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota. When he was 12 years old, after they moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota, they were actually Unitarians when they were in upstate New York. But when they moved to Cherry Grove, Minnesota, the whole town was Baptist. So it was known in that town on the 12th birthday that they would do a baptism. And what they did is they did it in the lake. But since he was born in January of 1848, and when he was 12 years old, when they did the baptism, they put them in the lake when it was frozen. But they left him in a little too long, his heart stopped, and he was seen to the other side. At that point, he was able to connect with his Native American guide, Seneca, and he was able to talk to an uncle that he had in spirit. And at that point, it changed his whole life.
Richard J. Russell is also a certified medium, healer, and teacher in Casadega.
He was in a seance in Iowa, and he had a Indian spirit guide named Seneca. And during the seance, Seneca came through to him and said, "You are supposed to start a spiritual center in the southeastern part of the United States." So being a good spiritualist, he follows his guide. And the next spring, he gathered a couple friends and boarded a train to Chicago from Iowa. And from there, they boarded a train to Jacksonville, Florida. And from there, he boarded a steamboat and came down the St. John's River. And evidently, he was told to get off at Blue Springs Landing, and which is a very famous spring here in Florida.
His guide, Seneca, explained to him that he should come south and start a spiritualist camp.
The Reverend Dr. Lewis Gates is former pastor at Colby Memorial Temple in Casadega.
Well, George Colby started here when he came down. He started up at Jacksonville, came all the way to Blue Springs Landing, got off, and then walked most of the way all the way here, and he found Casadega. That was through his guide, Seneca. And a lot of people don't know this guy, Seneca, the guide, the unknown, and the philosopher. There were three guides that were actually with George Colby as he came into the organization. And he found this property, and just before it was supposed to be given by somebody else, he got a mule and he went to Gainesville, I think it was Gainesville at that point, and had to go ahead and sign the deed and quitclaim deed for this property.
Anita Evans is a certified medium and owner of the 1928 Joseph Snipes House in Casadega.
He came to Central Florida. His spirit guide, Seneca, touched in with him at the time and told him that he was going to be forming a spiritualist camp in Florida. And he needed to come here basically because he also had consumption tuberculosis, and he would find property here that had a spring, and that he would drink that water, and that water would cure him, which it did.
The Spiritualist Association from Lilydale, New York, visited many Central Florida towns in search of a suitable winter residence before deciding on Casadega. De Leon Springs was a leading contender as a site for a spiritualist community, and St. Petersburg, Tampa, Tarpon Springs, St. Augustine, Daytona, and New Smyrna were among other sites that were considered. Eventually, George P. Colby's donated land became the Casadega community. People can own their own homes here, but the Southern Casadega Spiritualist Camp Meeting Association owns the property on which they sit. Anita Evans.
It was donated by Mr. Colby to only and ever be a spiritualist camp. And so you could come here and you could build a house, or you can be a member and buy a house. The house would be yours, but the land would forever belong to the spiritualist camp.
The community of Casadega is designated as an historic district listed in the National Register of Historic Places. Richard Russell.
The two apartment buildings, Harmony Hall and Brigham Hall, are some of the oldest buildings surviving. We lost a lot of wooden houses and structures to fires over the years. In fact, George Colby's home was burned in the 60s. Harmony and Brigham were somewhere like 1898 or something like that. My house is right next to Harmony Hall. It was built in 1906. It's a three-story Victorian, and it's got the carving on the tree. That's from a spirit within the house that passed away, a little girl at 7 1/2.
At the entrance to Casadega is the Casadega Hotel, privately owned for nearly a century. Across the street from the hotel is the Andrew Jackson Davis Building, constructed in 1905. This building is now the Welcome Center and Casadega Bookstore, where visitors can schedule individual readings with resident mediums. Jody Martinez.
They built the hotel at one point, which back then was owned by the camp. And it was a three-story wooden structure, and there's one just like it, the old hotel, that stands in Lilydale to this day. It's identical to that. And then we had what we call now the Andrew Jackson Davis Hall and the camp bookstore. Back then, it was a barn-like structure, and then it turned into a building. And it wasn't until 1905 when it became a true building.
The Colby Memorial Temple was the first building constructed in Casadega in 1895. It was remodeled in 1918, but the building was torn down and replaced with a new temple in 1923. That building remains the centerpiece of the community. Reverend Deborah Ganberg and Reverend Dr. Sheldon Ganberg are co-pastors at Colby Memorial Temple.
A lot of people come here for healing. That's what draws them here, either healing through visiting a medium and having a message from a loved one, or just hands-on healing through spiritualist healing. And so we offer that in Colby Temple every Sunday during our services at our Wednesday evening night service, we offer the healing as well. So some people actually come for just the healing on Wednesday nights and not the message service. So Colby Memorial Temple is very important in that regard.
One of the beautiful things about Colby Temple is that we really try to create a safe place for people to come of all faiths and all religions. We don't have any particular dogma that we follow here. We feel that we are here to have people explore what spirituality is for them. And we feel that there's a difference between religion and spirituality. And if I was to coin us as a temple, we support people in finding out what God is for them. And we try to create a place where different perspectives are offered so people can figure it out for themselves.
Casadega is one of Florida's most unique historic communities. For more information, watch episode 63 of our Florida Frontiers television series about Casadega. Check your local PBS schedule, find it online at myfloridahistory.org, and on the Florida Historical Society YouTube channel. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, learn about upcoming events, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in 2013, as Florida commemorated the 500th anniversary of the landing of Juan Ponce de Leon on the peninsula, many historians and celebratory event planners struggled with the question of how to present the explorer, who is often caricatured as the searcher for the mythical Fountain of Youth.
If the inclusion or exclusion of Juan Ponce de Leon from college-level textbooks is any indication, he is generally allotted only a sentence or two, or ignored entirely. In a 2015 article titled "Throwing the Explorer Out with the Fountain," Roger Chapman surveyed college American history textbooks spanning a date range from the 1870s to 2013, and notes that despite Ponce's impressive list of accomplishments, quote, when compared with the other explorers of his day, he is admittedly less well known, end quote. Citing Elisha Benjamin Andrews' 1904 History of the United States, Chapman declares the scholar's treatment of Ponce a narration with, quote, some detail and fairly accurate, end quote. In comparison, the 2013 edition of the popular America, A Narrative History by George B. Tyndall and David E. Shee, quote, render the Florida expedition in a single sentence. Juan Ponce de Leon, then governor of Puerto Rico, made the earliest known exploration of Florida in 1513, end quote. Chapman then lays out his analysis for why Ponce de Leon deserves a more thorough treatment of his role in the so-called Age of Exploration. Chapman argues that although Juan Ponce was not as well known as some of his contemporaries, textbooks, quote, could better inform readers of this man's importance in American history, end quote. Ponce was, quote, a crew member of Christopher Columbus's second voyage to the Western Hemisphere and was on hand for the European discovery of San Juan Bautista, Puerto Rico, which is now an unincorporated territory of the United States. He later colonized San Juan Bautista and, as the provincial governor, helped establish the city of San Juan, which today boasts the oldest European-made structures on U.S. territory. On April 3, 1513, he became the first European to officially set foot on land that is now part of the state of Florida, whatever spot that may have been. During the 1513 Florida voyage, he was the first recognized European to discover the Gulf Stream, end quote. Chapman also notes that, quote, in certain aspects, American history begins in Florida. Citing Robert H. Fuson's 2000 book, Juan Ponce de Leon and the Spanish Discovery of Florida, he makes larger claims for the Florida voyage. Quote, by the time that St. Augustine was settled, the entire Atlantic coast of America, from today's Florida to southern Canada, was known as La Florida.
Connie, in his 2003 Short History of Florida, Michael Gannon claims, quote, not until the year 2055 will an American flag have flown over Florida as long as did the flag of Spain, end quote. And yet the Spanish influence on Florida, like the story of Ponce, appears very briefly, if at all, in the national narrative.
Chapman traces the omission to some of the earliest textbooks published in the late 19th century and offers an explanation rooted in inherited historical perspectives. An 1896 textbook includes chapters on Indians, Norsemen, Columbus, Americus Vespucius and Balboa, Sir Francis Drake and Captain John Smith and Virginia, but no Ponce and no Florida. As he notes later, quote, even when the Spanish get credit, as in Harry J. Carman's 1967, A History of the American People, a negative slant prevails. Quoting Carman, quote, in Florida, St. Augustine was the only important town founded by the Spanish. It had a population of about 5,000 when the English took control of it in 1763, end quote. Chapman attributes the omission of Spanish influence on colonial North America to what he labels as Hispanophobia, quote, a legacy of the rivalry between Spain and England during the colonial period, a rivalry over land and religion, end quote, pitting Protestant England against Catholic Spain. English writers and historians pointed to the Inquisition and the brutal reputation of Spanish conquistadors while depicting English actions in the language of settlement. As one mid-19th century textbook explains, quote, the Spaniards were cruel and avaricious. They did not come to America to till the soil and follow honest labor, but with extravagant hopes of becoming suddenly rich from mines of gold and silver. But the English were industrious people who loved liberty and humanity and earned success by energetic toil in the fields, end quote. Casting Spain in the role of other, cruel, brutal, anti-liberal, and an enemy of freedom complicated any history of Florida and Juan Ponce de Leon.
And clearly a case can be made that Ponce deserves more attention in the national narrative than he has received, but that still begs the question, how should historians deal with the story that every child knows about the search for the Fountain of Youth?
Tracing the source of the tales that Ponce sought the Fountain of Youth proves as problematic as other aspects of the Florida voyage. As early as 1871, some scholars cast doubt on the story. In a 1948 book on Florida, Catherine Hanna noted that the fountain story was ubiquitous in Ponce's time and asserted that there was, quote, no real evidence that the stories influenced Ponce's decisions, end quote. Journalist T.D. Allman claimed that Washington Irving concocted the story in his 1828 book, Voyages and Discoveries of the Companions of Columbus. But Irving spent 7 years conducting research at the National Archives in Madrid and consulting with Spanish historians before writing his book. Knowing Irving's extensive research would seem to negate claims that he concocted the story. Rather than an endless debate over whether Ponce searched for a fountain of youth in a specific place, Chapman offers a more compelling analysis of the narrative. In his 1992 book, The Buried Mirror, Reflections on Spain and the New World, Carlos Fuentes observed, quote, the conquistadors were driven not only by the lust of gold, but by fantasy, illusion, imagination, end quote. This important observation, according to Chapman, shows how the fountain story is indicative of the culture in which Ponce and his companions existed and explains not only the fountain myth, but also the search for Cibola, El Dorado, and the Houses of Sun. As Chapman explains, Stories about the myths and legends that inspired the Spanish explorers may seem absurd and idiosyncratic to a modern readership, but they nonetheless humanized the Spaniards by highlighting their curiosity and sense of wonder. As Chapman concludes, quote, "The limited record on Juan Ponce was not always handled judiciously as the top scholars focused their attention on other conquistadors. Textbook writers looked over the shoulders of other writers, passing along the same mistakes," end quote. While the Fountain of Youth may be, quote, "Florida's most enduring myth," as J. Michael Francis asserts, by giving Juan Ponce de Leon's short shrift, American history books miss an opportunity to show that at one level, America's oldest European roots are actually Spanish, end quote.
And it is ironic that one of the most popular stories from Florida history is actually a myth. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. As Sebastian Garcia reports, the 1927 courthouse in Orlando is now the Orange County Regional History Center.
Rachel Williams serves as a historian for the Orange County Regional History Center. Rachel recently delivered a presentation about the history of the Orange County Courthouse. The earliest county courthouse dates back to 1857, when the area known today as Orlando became the county seat.
Because it has the county seat, it would need a courthouse. And a man from Alabama, originally, last name Caldwell, he donated, I think, 4 acres of land to the county to use as the site of the courthouse, and that would become really the center of early Orlando. In the meantime, they really had a small, like, log cabin, a little two-room log cabin that was also a church and a schoolhouse that was down on Pine Street while they were getting funding and stuff to build the actual structure. And then that was completed in 1857. It was just a small wooden structure. And then that burnt down mysteriously, I think 5 years later, but they rebuilt it, I think, a year after it burnt down.
In 1875, Henry Sanford proposed relocating the county seat to Mellonville, present-day Sanford, which would have moved the original 1857 courthouse from its location in present-day Heritage Square Park in downtown Orlando. Jacob Summerlin opposed the idea, offering $10,000 to maintain and expand the county courthouse in Orlando.
Henry Sanford comes and wants to propose Mellonville, as you said, modern-day Sanford, to be the county seat. But Jacob Summerlin didn't like the idea, didn't find it necessary that the seat be moved. So he offered $10,000 to build a new courthouse. We needed a new courthouse at the time just because the city had been growing so much. And so a little two-story courthouse wasn't, you know, meeting the needs of the community anymore, so they needed to build bigger. So Summerlin put up the money for that on the contingency that it stays in Orlando.
Orlando's population continued to grow, and as a result, a generation later in 1892, the city built another county courthouse, moving the 1875 Summerlin structure for the new construction. Many residents admired the unique structure of the 1892 courthouse and regarded it as an iconic landmark in the city.
We had outgrown that 1857 courthouse, so we needed something bigger. So they moved the 1875 Summerlin courthouse to become the Tremont Hotel. So that moved, and then they built this big, beautiful Romanesque Revival courthouse with this clock tower and this clock that was installed a few years after the actual courthouse opened. But that really became a visual, iconic part of the city. I saw like in newspaper articles, they referred to the tower as Big Ben. I also read in the Eve Bacon book that the clock itself was made by the same company that manufactured the Big Ben clock, but I went through and did some research and that was not true. So I don't know where that came from, but they did refer to it as like Orlando's Big Ben. It was a really iconic figure throughout its life in Orlando.
The life of the 1892 courthouse lasted until 1957, outliving its original purpose as a county courthouse by 30 years, when the city constructed a newer courthouse in 1927. Its beloved appeal partly contributed to its longevity after 1927, particularly with a group called the Antiquarian Society, which, in 1942, started using the space to exhibit historical artifacts from Orlando's past in an effort to preserve the old 1892 structure. The present-day Historical Society of Central Florida, which oversees the Orange County Regional History Center, refers to this moment in 1942 as its origin.
The predecessor of what would become the Central Florida Historical Society is known as the Antiquarian Society. It got its start in 1942, and they started by putting these exhibits in there. So they kind of used that as like, okay, well, this is still our civic center and where, you know, our community really gathers and a structure that we value. So they used it as partially as a place to exhibit things. And this, again, you know, was at the time when the 1927 courthouse, which is now the museum, had already existed, but they still wanted to keep the 1892 courthouse as part of the community. But that only lasted until 1957, when they had to demolish the 1892 courthouse because it had kind of fallen into disrepair. Bricks were falling, which is a hazard. There's also a tree growing out of the roof of it, which is really interesting. But so they did have to tear it down, which a lot of Orlandoans were very sad about because, again, it was this iconic visual of the city.
As Rachel mentioned, the 1927 courthouse today houses the Orange County Regional History Center, deepening its historical connections with Orange County government.
The interest of the Antiquarian Society to preserve, you know, it's really been about preservation. They wanted to preserve that 1892 courthouse. Unfortunately, that couldn't be kept, but we can still preserve this building, and I don't see this building going anywhere for a very long time. So it definitely does cross over between preservation and our government structure. And the History Center is dually governed between both the Historical Society and Orange County government. So we still are working together to preserve Central Florida history.
In 1960, Orange County attached an annex building to the 1927 courthouse in the space where the 1892 structure once stood. Asbestos concerns prompted the closure of the annex in 1989, and in 1997, Orange County opened its present-day 23-story courthouse on North Orange Avenue. Since then, the History Center has occupied the former 1927 courthouse. In tandem, Orange County has experienced 7 different courthouses since the mid-19th century, reflecting a deeper history of growth in the Central Florida area.
Between 1920 and 1930, Orlando saw a huge growth spurt. The population tripled in that decade. So even by the time this courthouse was 3 years old, there had already been thousands more people living here. So it's just the exponential growth of the city really made a new courthouse necessary. It just shows that we've always been growing. We've had one in the 50s, burnt down 60s, and then the 75 courthouse and the 92 courthouse. So we keep, you know, every 25-ish, give or take years, having new courthouses and an annex, and we're just continuously growing. And even now, like in the last, since what, 2019, we've had another huge population boom. So we continue to grow.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Happy New Year. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.